Welcome to Wolf Cub Film Club. On this episode, we take a look at the recent Netflix docuseries Beckham. Directed by Fisher Stevens, the series follows David Beckham's meteoric rise from humble beginnings to global football stardom. Something to be aware of if you're listening for the first time, whenever there's a spoiler, you'll hear the sound of a howling wolf. Before we get into it, Wolf and I would like to acknowledge Manchester United and England legend Sir Bobby Charlton, who passed shortly after recording this episode. He sure was one of the all-time greats. All right, guys, enjoy this one.
Should we talk about the filmmaker and then perhaps his style and then move on to some of the themes in the film? And if we get past the themes, we can talk about some of the actual events within the film.
I also think we should mention that you're an avid Manchester United fan, and you have been since you were a child.
Yes, well, I identify strongly with David Beckham's father, Ted, because he's pretty much my generation and grew up with an obsession with Manchester United and with Bobby Charlton in particular. And Bobby Charlton, of course, was my childhood hero. And I've supported Manchester United ever since the Munich disaster when I was a very, very small boy. And there was a lot of sympathy for the team. So, yes, it's worth pointing that out. I guess I come from a Man U background.
And me being in Europe and you being at home in Australia, are we going to refer to soccer as football and being as it's an American doco series, I shall be referring to it as football. I've been in Europe too long to call it soccer anymore.
I think that's fine. And I think people in Australia now understand more fully that football is actually soccer and AFL or rugby is a different kind of ball game.
Yeah, but let's start with the filmmaker.
Yeah, what have you found out about this guy, well, Fisher Stevens?
I'm actually really impressed with his body of work. He's got 105 acting credits. He's got 25 directing credits and 45 producing credits. These are like, you know, serious body of work behind him. I didn't realize he had such a body of work behind him. And also he was in, as an actor, he was in my favorite film as a kid, which is Short Circuit, about the robot in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was the guy in that. So I found that kind of nostalgic and cool. He also did the Leonardo DiCaprio doco, which I have just forgotten the name of.
Before the Flood.
Before the Flood, which I enjoyed. I enjoyed that doco a few years back. So, yeah, quite the body of work behind him. And I was curious as to how he came to this project. I was wondering that. I just wondered, is he a football fan? What drew him to the project? And I read that it was actually DiCaprio, having worked with him, who recommended him to Beckham. And that was where the seed started.
He's an unlikely choice, you would think, at first analysis, as a director of a documentary about David Beckham. He's American, Beckham's English. You would think there would be lots of English doco makers falling over themselves to get the invitation. But in other ways, I think he's actually terrific because he is clearly engaged with the subject. But when he got into it, he didn't know a great deal about Beckham. As he found out more about Beckham and Beckham's life, he became more and more drawn in and engaged by the story. And so I think he has that slightly outsider role as a director, which, you know, is important in the making of a film like this. I mean, Beckham apparently said he wanted a film made about him before someone else made a film about him. That's not to say he had control, because the agreement was that he wouldn't have final cut. And on that basis, Fisher Stevens agreed to do the doco. He also made The Cove, which is a quite well-known doco about dolphins, capturing of dolphins and so on, illegal capturing of dolphins, which became quite a cult film a few years ago. So he's done a lot of environmental films, such as Before the Flood. And it's interesting that at the end of this, both Victoria Beckham and David separately say that making the film has been kind of therapy for them. And I think reading about Fisher Stevens' experience with the film, he realized that Beckham and Victoria, to some extent, had never talked about a lot of this stuff, and it was very hard work to get them to do so. But he obviously had that knack of gaining their trust, and it's such a candid film, really, when you think about it, isn't it? Very frank.
Yeah, and it's interesting. He's also said in some articles that he, because they'd seen him on like shows such as Succession and things, some of the participants perhaps felt they already at least knew something of him in a way, which helped him kind of get a foot in the door with them. I guess that's the interesting thing. It's different than coming from like perhaps a hard-hitting journalist or you know, which might perturb the participants in a way. So it's an interesting angle to for him to come from.
Yeah. So in Succession, he plays Hugo, Logan Roy's publicist, and is constantly being told by Logan to, spin some story or other in a way that'll benefit the company. And he's this kind of, I recall him as this fairly downtrodden character within the series. And I think he also mentions that it was working with all those English actors. Because Succession is actually an English series, although it's about Americans. And when he mentioned the possibility of, oh, I've been offered this Beckham doco, do you think I should do it? All the English actors said, yeah, get onto it. You've got to get onto it, man.
Apparently, Brian Cox, who's the lead guy, is mates with Alex Ferguson as well.
That's right. Well, they're both Scots, of course. So, and probably he's a horse race fan the same as Sir Alex, so that's interesting.
One classic thing, I'm maybe jumping ahead a bit, but one classic thing is it reminded me when, like, Alex Ferguson, ex-Manchester United manager, you know, one of the most prolific Premier League managers of all time. It reminded me how you and I used to have a chuckle every time we watched one of his post-match press conferences because we couldn't understand a word he
Yeah,
said.
it's pretty broad Scots accent. Yeah, well, he did fantastically well to get Sir Alex into the film, along with a whole host of participants, an impressive list of participants and former players and coaches. Except notably, and we'll come on to this later, I'm sure, he couldn't get Glenn Hoddle, the English coach, who was quite instrumental at one part of Beckham's story. And there was no sign of Ryan Giggs, for example. All of the Have you seen the doco, The Class of '92, which is the
Yeah, I remember.
right? Yeah, that's the story of the young players that Sir Alex brought through into the Manchester United team, all kind of locally bred and gone through the Manchester United Academy that formed the basis of the team that eventually won the treble in 99, of which David Beckham was one of those. And I felt a little disappointed with this film in the sense that Beckham rarely, if ever, gives credit to the other players in the team. I mean, fair enough, it's a film about him, and they all appear to sing his praises in the doco, but he rarely kind of acknowledges the role that they played. And I think the Class of '92, which was made, I think, around 2012 or 13, is quite a good antidote to that. So, Paul Scholes Gary Neville, all of those people are in the film, but no Ryan Giggs. And I did wonder whether that was anything to do with the legal troubles that he's had.
True.
I don't know, but it would have been nice to see Ryan.
I thought Gary Neville was absolutely classic in this doco series. And he, in terms of what you're saying, he acknowledges straight up that he was, I think he describes it as being the mustard and, you know, Beckham's the beef. He's like the garnish. He needed to serve Beckham, and he was well aware of his role, and he was fine within that role, and he knew that that's what he had to do. So he had no issue in doing that. But yeah, Beckham, I don't think Beckham really did the same in return.
No, Beckham doesn't acknowledge them. But, you know, it has to be said that the film is about him and Victoria. It's not really about the other players. But I did think that, you know, he might give some credit to the other guys. It's very much a film like a couple we've already looked at. When you break it down, it's essentially archive. And what a rich vein of archive has been tapped in the making of this film, and interviews to camera. So much as with Senna and Amy, the Amy Winehouse film, both of which we've discussed in previous episodes of the Film Club. This is another example where, one of the advantages for Fisher Stevens was that David Beckham gave him access to his personal archive, a lot of personal footage of him with the Spice Girls and behind the scenes family stuff. Incredible archive, really. I mean, of course, all the football is there and all the games, but there's that those other aspects which are really rich within the film. I thought it was interesting the way he interviewed Beckham. Beckham is often oblique to the camera. In other words, the camera isn't set up in front of him. It's to the side, and he's got his head turned towards the camera. And that gave it, for me, a kind of informality, which I thought worked really well.
But then they do these close-ups when they're watching.
Yes.
Rewatching some of the footage. It's in close and front on.
I was going to ask you whether you'd noticed and what you thought about that.
Yeah, like you say, it brought it suddenly more into the intensity of whichever moment it was to see them watching. I thought it was an interesting approach.
Yeah, it was pretty big close-ups of the faces, but he obviously used Errol Morris's Interrotron. Errol Morris is a filmmaker who, he wanted people to look down the barrel of the camera when he was talking to them, but he wanted them to be talking to him at the same time. So he invented this thing he called an Interrotron, which was really a system of mirrors, which allowed him to sit in the corner of the studio, and his image would be right in front of the camera lens, and through a two-way mirror, the camera would see the people's face looking straight into the camera.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's adapted that idea to get them to watch games. And it's brilliant because you see them reliving the games as they watch them, you know, and they break into a smile of recognition, or they frown, or, you know, and he does it with Beckham, but he does it with other players as well. And I thought it was a brilliant device to use. So stylistically, I think the film has got some interesting touches to it. And each episode starts with a bit of domesticity. You know, I don't know if you noticed that. Beckham with his beehives, or Beckham with his wardrobe and the layout of all his clothes, which reveal his OCD tendency. But each episode starts with a little bit of domesticity to remind us, I suppose, of the humanity of this man who's on the global stage for the rest of each episode in such a big way. And then they manage, it's four eps, and they manage to end each one with a cliffhanger, you know, as to what would kick off the next episode. And the only bit that I thought was a bit voyeuristic was they finish, I think, episode two with the promise of the affair, or the alleged affair that Beckham had, and which threatened his relationship with Victoria while they were in Spain, or while he was in Spain. And then in the next episode, that's dealt with fully. I thought using that as a kind of cliffhanger was a little bit sort of appealing to more baser emotions among the audience. But in general, I thought the storytelling was great. The difficulty, I think, for the director was to tell the story chronologically. I mean, what for you is the biggest story out of all the stories that are told?
Well, subjectively, once again, we're seeing the archetypal hero's journey, the hero who suddenly becomes like the villain and then has to
get redemption. What's the word?
Redemption is the word. It has to get redemption. So for me, you know, there's always that personal subjective experience to it and the relatable stuff. And I just remember that red card incident. So I've always remembered that. So that stood out to me, that, you know, the vilification aspect, his kind of downfall in a way, and the rebuilding, that for me, that was the biggest story.
Yeah, it's the biggest story in the series, I think, as a story. And the problem for the director is that that story actually happens quite early on in Beckham's career. I mean, the treble with Manchester United is pretty big too, but the red card is dealt with in the second episode, and in some ways that's a bit too early for the impact that it makes. And for me, once the red card, his redemption, and then the triumph of the treble were dealt with, it felt to me that the series, I mean, there was still plenty happening. There was Los Angeles and Real Madrid and all of that, but somehow it seemed to flag for me a little bit after the dramatic peaks of those stories.
Like I say, it stood out. I mean, I remember the 98 World Cup. I remember my dear sister, Sinead, being born that year, and her as a baby in the 98 World Cup. And I remember us having our hopes behind the England team, and then the incident happening at the time. Just didn't realize the extent of the vilification from the British tabloids and from the supporters, and how long that went on for. And, you know, having lived in the UK and stuff, these UK tabloids vilifying their own heroes has just been a constant through history. And it was quite shocking just how long Beckham weathered that storm at his own club, through the games, fans just giving him, I just don't think, he just didn't deserve that. But the passion of the British fans, you know, I spoke to a guy who played in the Premier League here, and that was his comment to me, was that, I said, what was it like? I think he was playing in the first division, and he said, the fans will eat you alive. That was his comment when I asked, what was it like playing? He's like, they will literally eat you alive. It's just classic, because when England lost that game, they had some archival footage of somebody throwing a TV out the window.
Yes, they did. They had it. And someone else who made up a Beckham puppet and hung it on a noose outside of his pub.
But, you know, the threats to the family, the safety aspect, he didn't deserve any of that. And the length of time it went on for was just crazy. But I think looking at Beckham, it seemed that, from the doco, it seemed that he internalized a lot of that. He just kind of sucked it up, weathered it, and it took its toll. Like, he internalized it. Eric Cantona appears in the doco series. It's not about Eric Cantona, because he had his moment of vilification where he fly kicked a fan, which was a huge incident at the time. But it wouldn't have been a surprise if, under that amount of lengthy pressure, Beckham at one point had some kind of outburst. And he didn't. He internalized it. He got on with the job. And I think it played a part in his determination to like get out from under that clout. But yeah, it was far more intense than I mean, we just saw that. And the incident was a provocation, you know, from Simone in Argentina. He was kind of, there was a provocation and Beckham did a strange kick while he was face down. So it was a grey incident and some people didn't think it should have been a red card. So to suffer for that long after that was really, really too much.
Absolutely. I remember the incident, but we weren't in England, we were in Australia. And like you, I hadn't realised just the extent to which he was abused and vilified and for how long that went on, and the vilification of Victoria as well. But one thing is that, well, there's two things. One is that, as his dad points out in the doco, England lost that game on a penalty shootout. You know, they could have won. After Beckham was sent off, Michael Owen equalised. It went to extra time and penalties. Nobody vilified the players who missed their penalties. They were just intent on vilifying Beckham. And I think you can't just blame the media. I think Glenn Hoddle has a big responsibility here, because he said the sending off cost us the game. That's what he said in his post-game interview. He threw him under the bus.
Yeah, he bust through. And I think Victoria had a very, was fair to say, Beckham was 23 years old. Like from a manager to do that and not you know, objectively look at the team as a whole. I mean, random shit goes down in football matches. And yeah, there's defining moments, but to put it all solely on his shoulders. I think I can't remember who said it in the doc. I think it was in the doco. So it might have been, I'm pretty sure it was this doco. It might have been, someone said, you know, the wind blows strongest at the top. I think that's what Beckham was experiencing, you know, this rapid climb and then the heat on him. It's some weird kind of expectation from the British public that kind of gets intensified, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a fantastic interview with Simeone when he says, he's kind of wryly smiles and he says, football's not just about skill and control, you know, it's about deception. And he admits to hamming it up when he fell to the floor under the so-called impact of Beckham's kick, which wouldn't have felled a mouse, never mind a footballer. And interestingly, I don't know if you recall, but Hoddle was Beckham's childhood hero, like Bobby Charlton was mine. And this reminded me of your story with Pelé, because his mum tells how she took him all the way to somewhere to see Glenn Hoddle sign a book and get his autograph. And they queued and queued and queued, and Hoddle didn't even show up. So Beckham was distraught by that, just as you were, and we've heard this story when we were talking about the Pelé doco, of you going to London and queuing for so long and then missing Pelé because security told him it was time to go.
The event that made me a man, yeah, at 16. Interestingly enough, Hoddle refused to be in the doco.
Yes.
So no comment on that in hindsight. For whatever reason that may be. And what I found classic in the doco was Beckham's mum.
Yeah.
She had they were talking about the Hoddle, and she's like, he's on my hit list. Like, I put people on my hit list.
Yeah, he's high on my hit list.
He's high on my hit list.
she was terrific. His mum. We'll have to talk a little bit more about his mum and his dad.
On the autograph thing, we had that Pelé story on a previous episode, but I would like to briefly mention, as Dad mentioned at the start, his childhood hero is Bobby Charlton. And when Dad went in for open heart surgery, I wanted to do something nice for the old man in preparation for what was to what he was about to go through. So I wrote I think it was handwritten. I don't even know if I typed it. I wrote a letter to the FA, to the Football Association, explaining that Bobby Charlton was Dad's boyhood hero and that Dad was about to have some serious surgery. And could I have an autograph for Dad? And lo and behold, a couple of months later in the mail arrived a Bobby Charlton postcard with a handwritten message wishing Dad all the best.
Hang on, let me just...
Dad's jumped out of his seat for the listeners. He's
because I've got the postcard here.
He's got it right there.
It's been on my notice board ever since. Picture of Bobby Charlton, the balding Bobby Charlton, and it says to Steve Thomas, best wishes from Bobby Charlton. And that was nearly 30 years ago, I think.
I was going to say, because another awesome character is the receptionist at Manchester United in the series. And maybe it went from the FA to her and then she had to pass it on to who knows. But the fact that he took the time to do that, I mean, he must receive mounds, you know, they must get piles and piles of letters. So the fact he took the time to do that was fantastic.
Yeah, I'd like to pay respects to Bobby, who's now in his late 80s, I think, and suffering with dementia. So where there used to always be a shot of him in the crowd at Manchester United games, it's only Sir Alex left, really, who's able to attend. You mentioned the effect on David Beckham of the whole vilification thing and the sending off, and it has clearly affected him and still does, because he says what I can't get over is that I embarrassed my parents. That's a statement that he makes in the film, and I think among other themes, this is a film about parenting, and it's particularly, I think, a film about fathering, if you like. Because Beckham had two fathers, his real father, Ted, and when he went to Manchester United from London, left his parents behind, Alex Ferguson became his, to all intents and purposes, his father and father figure. And of course, eventually, as the doco goes on to show, son had to rebel against father, which led to Beckham leaving Manchester United and going to Real Madrid. But there are, I think, interesting parallels between the parenting style, if you like, of Beckham's father, Ted, and Alex Ferguson. They were both tough love coaches or parents in that sense. Did you get that feeling?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think there's no question of the standards that Beckham's father set in terms of just getting good with both feet, doing thousands of kicks in the backyard, just the bread and butter of what it takes and the repetition and the the training was on a high level from so young, and then Ferguson bringing him in young, and even like he was just didn't realize as a teenager, like Ferguson just had him there at the club, like just seeing what was going on. But the the rebellion thing, that the sort of the Iron John, you know, there's the book Iron John about the father-son ethos, and there's a moment where the son ultimately stands up to the father. Like it's kind of a thing that happens in sons' lives, is there's one distinct moment where they rebel back, and perhaps the infamous boot kick was that. But I loved Ollie Gunnar Solskjaer's account of the boot incident, because it was his boot.
That's right.
And they're like, were you there? He's like, of course I was there. It was my boot that got kicked at Beckham from Ferguson and clipped Beckham's eyebrow, and was very controversial at the time. But yeah, obviously it was at the peak of whatever tension was in their relationship.
But it's not just the fact that his father had him, you know, repeating things again and again and again. It was the style of his parenting, which in the film he acknowledged. Well, I think Beckham says, "My dad never praised me." And you cut to Ted, and he says, "If I told him how good he was, he wouldn't have had anything to work on." How would you feel about that from your father? Never to get any praise, but to be constantly told to do this again and do it again and do it again.
I think, as you say, it's that generational thing. It's that you guys from the same generation where it's, you know, get on with it. But I actually agree with what Ted said about, you know, if I just pumped him up, where would the improvement come, you know?
Yeah, but it's a fine line between that and abuse.
Mm.
And then you get Sir Alex, who objects to Beckham getting his head shaved, won't allow him to wear white boots. He talks about how he turned up with white boots. Your boots had to be black. Alex Ferguson had fixed rules and ways that players had to behave. I remember, I think it's Gary Neville saying, if you said the F word to him, you only said it once. So for me, it's like, and I remember in the when you appeared in the documentary that we made about your under-16 soccer team, you bemoaned the fact that the coach wasn't strict enough and that was part of the problem.
I just think personally, I've realized how much I'm a person that needs validation, and it's okay. Like, you know, I used to read a lot of stuff about it. You know, it's not cool to constantly ask for validation. And I realized that, particularly in a professional sense and even in acting work and stuff, it's actually something that I need. And I really thrive from it. And you know, I praise my own son a lot. I just go at him with encouragement. But I do. It's a tough one because you can't just pump someone up all the time.
No, but validation is important and we all need it. And Beckham tells the story, I think it's after he's redeemed himself by scoring the equaliser against Greece in the next World Cup qualification campaign, and England go through to the finals, and he's now captain of the team. And he says, you know, I went back to training at Old Trafford, and Sir Alex never mentioned it, never said, well done, son. So again, you had that lack of validation. And you've also got Beckham's mum saying that she thought her husband was too tough. And this brings me to my main point in this debate, which is that Stevens is asking him, how did you get through that time of being the most hated man in Britain and all the abuse that you've got, etc., etc.? And Beckham keeps saying, I don't know, I don't know. All I could control was the way I played football. I don't know how I got through it. And then he says, I think I got through it because of the way my dad was when I was a kid. Now, he'd suffered 2 years of abuse by the British public. And the reason he was able to cope with that, it was because he had years of abuse from his father. And I just leave our three listeners to our little podcast to reflect on what they think about that and whether that's a good thing. I mean, there is a redeeming story there. I don't know if you recall, but when we now go forward to the winning of the treble, and the final part of the treble, which was the final of the European Championship against Bayern Munich, that game, as everybody knows, was lost in normal time and retrieved in injury time. They were 1-0 down. Both goals, scored by Sheringham and our friend Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, were the results of corners taken by Beckham, so he had two assists. And Stevens asked him, what was going through your mind when you had to take those corners and you knew how crucial it was? And Beckham says, because of my dad and the way he made me take corners again and again, and I put myself back in that frame of mind, put the ball exactly where you want it to go. And he said, that's how we did it.
It's like Star Wars. It's the father-son Darth Vader
Star Wars thing, and we need a wolf howl here. Final scene of the whole thing is Beckham taking free kicks with his son, and I've just realized that's like a culmination of this, as you said earlier, this parenting relationship. And what I thought was cool in that final scene is Beckham is saying, you just got to be relaxed. Like, you just got to relax and take the kick. Like, you're too tense. It's about relaxation.
Yeah, but how is he telling him to relax? He's saying, don't mind me. I've only won 8 Premier Leagues, 2 FA Cups and a couple of European Championships.
Relax.
Relax.
Well, that's what he's saying. He's saying no matter how intense the pressure cooker is, find your center within that. But like you're saying earlier, when he's taking those free kicks in the Champions League final, he's thinking about like what his dad said. But I guess that's him, you know, that's him finding his center. So when he's given his son the reel off of, he's intensifying the pressure cooker, but saying try and relax within that.
Yeah, I think it's a more relaxed sort of parenting mode, but it has a few echoes for me of his own dad, who he's tried to shake off. And he and Victoria say how they really keep the kids out of the doco as much as they can. They appear, I think, in those final couple of scenes, but in general, they're kept out of the film. And Beckham's statement is, well, we tried to bring up our kids as normal kids. So there's that parenting thread there as well.
And we haven't really addressed Victoria. How I mean, she went through her own ride as not only a pop star herself and the level of fame that the Spice Girls were. I thought it was cool, the stuff they showed about the Spice Girls, when they said that they were this band of individuals and they swore to keep their individuality within this. And I think that's what makes an awesome group, is when you have really strong, different individuals making a collaboration. But what she went through in terms of the continual moving, the decisions that were at times quite selfish by Beckham, you know, what he had to do for his appetite to just keep going and going at the highest possible level, but the uprooting of the family continuously, I empathized with that. What was your feeling toward her?
She never seems to be consulted. It's just, now David's going to Spain and I don't want to go to Spain. And now we've come to America and I really wanted to come to America, but he's decided to bugger off to wherever it is he went next, AC Milan, you know. And when he's finally retired and he's sitting at home, he suddenly says, oh, I'm off to start a soccer team in Miami, because he can't sit still. So it seems to me that Victoria's afflicted by this succession of David's decisions to move on to the next part of his career. And I feel for her in that sense.
The criticism I read in a review, you know, this one said that David got a bit of a free pass in terms of the affair, that it was not direct, that Stevens didn't directly fire the question. It was kind of scooted around, still addressed, but not as hard hitting as it could have been. And it also said that perhaps the relationship between Stevens and Beckham was a bit too buddy-buddy like, and it wasn't like hard hitting enough. I didn't fully agree with that. I mean, knowing that Beckham didn't have final cut and that they did address, you know, there was an unspoken thing there and it clearly took a toll on the marriage. Maybe they just didn't want to talk about it. Like, not everything has to be thrown on the table, but in terms of how it was addressed, it wasn't directly asked, did you have an affair? And what was that necessary, do you think?
I think Beckham answers that question by saying, ultimately, it's our private life, and that's the end of that conversation. In other words, I'm not going to say any more about it. Victoria's a bit more frank in that she talks about up to that point, you know, it was the world against us, but we were together. Now it was us against each other, as well as the world against us. And that's what made it very difficult. But they appear to have got through that period.
Which is remarkable.
It is remarkable. I felt a little uncomfortable about all that stuff. But, you know, on other levels, it is a very frank documentary, and they're very open and frank about things that have happened. I guess there are some things in our relationships which we just don't want to reveal or talk about in public.
Which is fair enough, I think, especially the scrutiny they've been under their entire lives. Like, you're entitled to work out, you know, we're all flawed and no one's perfect, and entitled to work that out behind closed doors if you wish. Doesn't have to all be out there. But I was pleasantly surprised with the series, because when I saw it pop up on the Netflix thing, I was like, oh, cool, it's a Beckham thing. But I really just thought it was going to be a very standard, one of these standard docos types of, here's the footage, here's what happened, with a narrator, you know. And I always crave that intimacy, as we've had with some of the docos, you know, this very close and this wealth of archival footage, and getting really into the intimate. And I did, on first look, I just, for some reason, didn't think it would have that. And then as soon as there was the beehive and those domestic moments, as we said, they started with, I was like, ah, cool, this is what I really, really dig. So then I was right into it.
Yeah. You forget that this couple are worth, between them, over £400 million. They look like ordinary human beings. But more important for me than the business about the affair, you know, I think thematically this is not just a film about parenting, it's a love story. And there is the love story between David and Victoria and the ups and downs of that. But there is also the competing love of a person for soccer. And that's where the tension is in the relationship between Victoria and David, is that, like, the third person in the room is soccer. And it's, which will Beckham choose, Victoria or soccer? And I've watched the series twice now. And when he's going to Spain to play for Real Madrid, he makes a statement, I think it's in archive, which says, you know, asked why he's moving from Manchester and uprooting the family. He says, I love my family, but football is everything to me. In other words, football is more important. Later on in Los Angeles, when they go to America from Spain, and Victoria's really pleased because it's Hollywood and everybody speaks English and she can get the kids into school and all the rest of it, he says, family first, soccer second. So there is this.
Flips.
Yeah, well, there's this tension in his life. And then you get Cantona and Gary Neville talking about soccer as an addiction.
Yeah, that it takes extremity to go at it, that kind of extreme personality.
It's not so much the extreme personality, it's the adrenaline rush. And Cantona talks about how when you give up football, you've got to go through withdrawal because you're not getting that adrenaline rush, which is provided by the crowd when you play well. And Gary Neville says soccer is an addiction. So you've got this kind of, and love, you know, can be an addiction. But it reminded me, well, it reminded me of two things. It reminds me of the book, it reminds me of Fever Pitch by Nick Hornsby, which is a 1990s book about an Arsenal fan. And I remember it so well because there's a scene in there. Usually he goes to the game with his mates every week. But one week his girlfriend says, why don't you take me to the game? And so he takes her to the game. The crush of the fans is so great, she faints. And he can't attend to her because he can't take his eye off the game. So, you know, someone else is singing to his girlfriend and he's riveted to the game. It also reminded me of your struggles when you were in a band and it was your girlfriend's birthday and you had a gig. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was a tussle. I think I've mentioned it before, but just this balance between what we crave as humans, which is, loving, supportive relationships. And then when you have this drive, this thing and a relationship can be really, really challenging. And yeah, my first girlfriend kind of put it on the line. It's the gig or the family event. And in that case, I chose the gig, but I was devastated because I didn't want to lose the relationship. But in hindsight, it wasn't meant to be. We had very, very different goals. But trying to juggle it at the time, I can relate to that. The interesting thing with Victoria is she said she doesn't actually like football. She likes watching him, and that she would watch whatever he did. I think she says if he was painting a wall, she would be happy to do that. So for her, it was more about him doing his thing than the spectacle of football.
Yeah. I remember there's one scene where she's about to give birth, I think, to the second child, and Beckham's off on a photo shoot with Beyonce.
And she wasn't happy.
No, and some other.
Rightly so. Yeah, but what was horrendous for Victoria is when she was vilified by the press and the fans just as much. And, she was advised by a doctor to have a cesarean. And then the press wrote "too posh to push" as their headline. It's like, Jesus, she was just following a doctor's advice. How one would deal with that level of scrutiny and make it through is quite epic.
Yeah. I think another important theme in the film, which we've, commented in other films, is about memory and contradictions between people. So Beckham will say, as he does, success didn't change me. And then you cut to Alex Ferguson, who says, he changed. It was hard to keep his feet on the ground. Or when they're in LA and Beckham's playing with a bunch of amateur footballers, really, and it's a disaster. They lose 12 games in a row, and he's saying, I wasn't happy. I was embarrassed. I wasn't happy. And then you cut to Victoria saying, I was so happy in LA. It was the best place we've lived in. So you constantly get these contradictions where you cut from one person who says A to another person who says the diametric opposite. And I think that's what humanity is all about, really.
Perspective.
Yeah, perspective and just disagreements. There's a terrific story you mentioned. Is it Kath, the old receptionist? Or was it his mum you mentioned? Did you mention her or not?
Both. The mum at the hit list, but yeah, the dear old lady who's been on the Manchester reception she's awesome too, because particularly when some of that hate mail came in and she was just like refusing to acknowledge it.
Yeah, but she tells this hilarious story. When they were playing against Bayern Munich and in the final leg of winning the treble, it got to full time and they were 1-0 down. And she says, I said to my husband, bugger it, I'll go and make a cup of coffee. So she goes out and they score. She comes running back in and her husband says, well, now they've scored, there'll have to be extra time. So she said, oh, all right, well, I'll go and finish making the coffee. She goes out the room and misses the second goal.
That's the football experience right there, isn't it?
It is, really. You turn your head at the wrong time and you miss the action.
Well, it's like when we saw Gazza score one of the greatest goals in history. We were in Wembley Stadium, and I always said it was like time stood still when that goal happened. And for me, it was a real crazy outpouring of because I had been like the only guy who was born in England in high school and had been like fighting for England for for 5 years, and then all of a sudden I was there with 80,000 people watching Gazza score. And then, of course, after we met Gary Neville on the bus, we waited for the England bus. I had a strange exchange with David Seaman, the goalkeeper, who was sitting on the bus. I kind of reenacted him saving the penalty in that game, which he was chuffed by. And then we got Gary Neville's autograph and he stole our pen.
Yeah, you passed the pen through the bus window and the autograph came back, but no pen. He's still got that pen.
He can keep our pen. He can keep our pen. So we've got the Bobby Charlton autograph and the Gary Neville autograph. One thing I didn't mention at the very start was just I love the Manchester music scene at the time when Beckham was a young player. You know, that's a whole thing of itself. The bands that came out of the Manchester music scene, the Stone Roses, Oasis, like I love that era of music in that place that came out of that time. And there was the big club, the Hacienda, which was a big part of this Manchester scene. So I love that some of those tracks were play, you know, were on the soundtrack in that early stuff. I just wanted to mention. But Beckham kind of playfully said he'd never been to the Hacienda, but then he acknowledged that he probably had.
I recognised Oasis on an Oasis track. And then after he'd scored against Greece and got England through to the World Cup and went back to Old Trafford, and Alex never praised him, in the background they're playing Give Me Some Lovin'. So, yeah, it's almost a separate exercise to go through and listen to the music, which I think is quite well done. But going back to the story of us at Wembley and the bus and Gazza's goal, I thought to myself, well, Gary Neville was playing, Phil Neville was playing, where was Beckham? And Beckham wasn't playing. But the sequence of events was he wasn't playing, and then at the beginning of the next season, still 96, I think, he scores that amazing goal from the halfway line when he lobs the keeper.
Halfway.
Yeah, which he became an immediate star for.
Gazza's goal was before that.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And then he scores his amazing goal and then he gets picked for England. So we missed seeing Beckham play for England by, you know, a few months. But when we saw Gary Neville, he was only 21 years old and he was already established. Mm. You know, he was a great player. He might describe himself as the mustard to Beckham's beef, but he actually was a great player himself, as was Paul Scholes, Ryan Giggs and the rest of the class of 92.
And what I was going to say earlier was just the length of a footballer's career, like, you know, it could be short. We're talking perhaps a 10-year. I mean, Beckham was obviously groomed from very, very young. But in terms of the career peak, it can be a relatively 10-year block of time, perhaps, you know, maybe 23 to 33, maybe 33 is kicking on. So Beckham was, he says it, you know, he was smart. He wanted a life after football, and that was the brand, you know, that was the brand. He had a perspective of the potential length of the career. And I mean, if you're lucky as a player, you get two dips at a World Cup. Beckham had his vilification incident and then he was the hero getting them into the next one. So a player's career is incredibly short in retrospect in terms of the whole life. So the tumultuous stuff in the family, you know, it's tumultuous, but it's a distinct kind of block of time.
Yeah. And I mean, he's still only 47, I think. And of course, has now started up the Miami, whatever it is, soccer team and taken Lionel Messi.
Into Miami.
Into Miami. And he's got Lionel Messi playing there.
Yeah, but that's been controversial since because Messi played the first game, scored this awesome free kick and won the game in their first match, but he hasn't been playing since. So now the fans are firing up at him now. You know, what's he doing? He's not playing.
Well, you know, when they played that game, the treble win against Bayern Munich, We were flying back from a visit to the UK, and while the game was on, we were in Heathrow Airport checking in for our flight. And in the departure lounge, there was about 250 guys stood on chairs and riveted to the game. They were still 1-0 down with a couple of minutes to go. And on the tannoy, it's saying, you know, flight whatever to Melbourne, please come through. Anne's there with Sinead, who's a baby. And she's saying, come on, we've got to go, we've got to go. And I'm saying, hang on, you know, it's not over yet. And Anne decides, she said, well, I'm not missing the plane. She went. As she goes, they score. I'm hugging grown men that I've never met before. And she's gone off through the departure lounge to get on the plane. Now, fortunately, it didn't go to extra time, so I caught the plane. If they'd gone to extra time, would I have missed the plane? I don't know.
Plane flights can be a real inconvenience when it comes to football. But yeah, that again, that was the dilemma right there, the family football life. And who's the guy in Ted Lasso who says, you know, football is life?
Yes, football is life. But, you know, I rate this doco pretty highly. And Anne was riveted to it as well. And she's not a soccer fan at all. So it's a bit like Senna. You don't have to be a motor racing fan to get involved with this story. I did wonder whether they should have called it Beckham and Posh rather than just Beckham, but I suppose...
Or Beckhams.
Or the Beckhams, yeah. I think there's a slight sense in which Victoria's a bit put in the background in this story, but there it is.
Well, in connection to the stuff we've been talking about ethics, you mentioned it earlier, this Netflix model of having to finish everything with a cliffhanger to keep people binging series. And I get it. Like, but it's like, if you know it's a four-part series and you're into it, this, we've got to keep you gripped at the end of every, you know, we've got to write it in so that the audience do not switch off. You know, it's so strategically played around keeping you binging as many episodes as possible. And in this case, it's fine. I was going to watch the whole thing right through. I didn't need any form of like, but yeah, I just tussle with that. I'm like, oh, here we go. There has to be the cliffhanger so that we watch an entire series in one night. And then the next night we're looking for the next series to binge. It's the crazy.
Yes. Yes. That's right. And when they have a series that they only release one app a week, we get frustrated now.
Like old school TV.
Yeah. We've been so conditioned into the binging model that we get frustrated when they only drop one every week. There was one other thing I wanted to say. Oh, yes. It's amazing in Beckham's career how coaches, he had problems with the assistant coach at Man U. He moves to Real Madrid and they appoint the guy as their coach.
That is weird, random, yeah.
Capello is coach at, ends up coach at Real Madrid because they get through five coaches or something while Beckham's there and then starts coaching England. And Beckham's had this run-in with Capello at Real Madrid and moved on, and suddenly, you know, there he is, the England manager. So yeah, can you believe it, really?
Right, crazy, random. That was really random, like the assistant coach to take that position. But then again, Beckham was an outcast because of his return. Was it the LA thing with Madrid? But he was just training but running on the sidelines, and they wouldn't give him a game, they wouldn't let him train with the squad. Again, he just weathered the storm and just showed that he was just going to keep trudging along, and that in turn garnered him the respect from the manager.
That was Capello, because Beckham had started talking to LA Galaxy independently of the club, and the club found out. Capello froze him out And yeah, you see all this footage of him training on his own. And quite clearly, Capello expected him to capitulate and give up and whatever, and he didn't. He just kept training on his own, kept himself fit. And eventually, to save his own neck, because he wasn't doing very well, Capello had to put him back in the team, which he did. And then, you know, he becomes the England coach. And he tells Beckham, if you want to play for England, you've got to go back to Europe. No good playing in the American League. And that's when he goes to Milan. And the Americans get upset. He goes to Milan, wants to stay there, and they won't let him stay there. And Victoria doesn't want to leave anyway. So you get these constant sort of dramas playing out. It reminds me of the saying at the head of our little film, Dan, from Rudyard Kipling. Take triumph and disaster and treat them as the same impostors.
Makes a lot more sense to me now.
Yeah. But Beckham's career is so up and down. It's from extreme, as he says, the most hated man in Britain 1 year, 2 years later, the captain of England. So the ups and the downs that they have to deal with at that kind of level is amazing. And that was the other thing that struck me, was the ego of these players. I mean, Beckham, in a way, is an egoless player. But, you know, you've got Ole Gunnar Solskjaer saying when they finally brought him on in the game against Bayern Munich, well, and how did you feel? Well, I thought it was just a bad time they brought me on, you know. And when he gets played, I think, by Ferguson instead of Beckham, when Beckham's fallen out with Ferguson, and they ask Ollie what he thought about that, he says, well, I was faster than Beckham.
Yeah,
and
quicker.
Some of Simeone and some of the other, you know, they quite clearly, they all think they're like the best player that there is. And I guess in a way you've got to think that if you're going to play at that kind of level.
Well, and Beckham was just clearly a cut above, just clearly.
Yeah. The way he took free kicks.
Yeah, set pieces.
Set pieces.
Both feet. I also, we could really go on, but I remember that other one, where the 90 Minutes doco where you watch Zidane.
Oh, yes.
You have Zidane's perspective of what it's like to be in a game. The cameras are on Zidane for a Champions League match. And I just remember you realize, one, they're not very often on the ball. Like, they sort of bursts of action and then a long period of nothing. And I think Zidane scores a goal and gets booked or something in that game.
He gets sent off.
Does he? He gets a red card.
He scores and then gets sent off.
But what I do remember about that doco is Beckham is everywhere. You see Beckham all the time, present all the time, darting around. And that was my one thing I got from that. I was like, wow, Beckham's really very involved constantly.
Yeah, he was a hard worker. But he had hard-working parents, and so did Victoria, and that's what brought them together in the first place.
The working class.
The working class. Although her dad took her to a school in a Rolls Royce.
In a Rolls Royce.
According to Beckham, who sticks his head in the door. There's some quite amusing moments in the film. Very enjoyable.
Very enjoyable. I just liked it when Beckham started to roll in cash and was just spending it. And Gary Neville, the Neville brothers are quite working class. Like, you know, they would have been on serious coin. But Neville's like, he's like, he rocked up to training with a pen. He's like, who buys a pen?
Yeah, I think his brother says, oh, Beckham, have money, must spend it. He liked things, and Beckham says, yeah, I do, I like things. Yeah, now he can like £415 million worth of things if he wants to, which is extraordinary. Yeah,
well, nice one. Always great to combine our love of film and football.
Yes, indeed, it's the ideal sort of situation,
combination.
Yeah, we'll wait for the next one.
There you go, guys. Beckham is on Netflix. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you have a filmmaking question or a film or series or doco you'd like to recommend, you can reach out on our Instagram at Wolf Cub Film Club. We'll catch you on the next episode.